Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of March. There's a wonderful exhibit. There are always wonderful exhibits at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And this hour, we're so fortunate to have two people who know the exhibit very well and have put this marvelous exhibit of Jan Leavens together. Lori Winters is here in studio with us. Lori is curator of earlier European art at the museum, where she's been since 1997. And her academic specialty is French and Central European painting. She's responsible, though, for a wide spectrum of media and of different periods. She has organized some marvelous exhibits, including some of the best attended shows ever put together by the museum. Among them, a Renaissance treasury, the flag collection of European decorative arts and sculpture, Leonardo da Vinci and the Splendor of Poland, a history of collecting and patronage, a huge hit here in Milwaukee, Rembrandt and his time, masterworks from the Albertina, and most recently, Biedermeier, the invention of simplicity, actually most recently the exhibit that we're talking about this hour. Always a pleasure to see you, and thank you so much for coming to our studios. Hello, Lori.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
We also have and are happy to have Walter Liedtke with us. He has been curator of European paintings at the Metropolitan Museum of Art since 1980 and has lectured and published widely on Dutch artists Rembrandt and Vermeer. At the Metropolitan, he's curated the exhibitions Rembrandt, Not Rembrandt in the Metropolitan Museum of Art and also Vermeer and the Delft School and the Age of Rembrandt, Dutch paintings in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And Walter, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Isn't it interesting that you have this person who's done such incredibly gorgeous paintings who has remained pretty much unknown until people like you have discovered him and put him on display and people love these paintings? Why don't we know very much about him?
Well, that's I think that's a complicated answer. And if you don't mind, I'd like to take a stab at it, and then
sure,
and then because Walter and I actually haven't discussed this, so I'd like to hear him talk about it as well.
Okay,
it's an interesting thing because he's grown up in Leavens has grown up in the shadow of Rembrandt. This is the first exhibition on Jan Leavens in the United States. And there hasn't been a significant exhibition on him in a monographic way since 1979. That exhibition was held in Braunschweig, Germany. And interestingly, it was titled Jan Leavens in the Shadow of Rembrandt.
Oh.
So our tagline for the exhibition has been Out of Rembrandt's Shadow. And we're really, Arthur Wheelock, who is the curator of the exhibition from the National Gallery, has really tried to pull him out of the shadow of Rembrandt and to try to understand him as an independent artist. And I think Arthur's really done a good job of that. I mean, we used to think erroneously that Leavens was a student of Rembrandt, and we now know that that's not true. He was working at a much earlier date, and there's a lot of cross-influence between the two artists, but they do seem to have been two very independent spirits. Friends, perhaps even competitors, rivals at a certain point in their careers, and their paths cross again and again throughout their lives. So we're able to demonstrate that, but we're now looking at Leavens as an independent artist. And it may be that Rembrandt, who spent almost four decades in Amsterdam, was a little bit of the homeboy in the 19th, early 20th century when national identities were connected with cultural identity. The focus was on Rembrandt, and naturally so. Leavens left at a very young age to make his career in London and then Antwerp and Berlin, then back to Amsterdam. He was much more of what we might identify today as an international artist. Hmm. And in some ways, he became disconnected from the Dutch identity. And many of his works, in fact, do not look Dutch. There are no Dutch landscapes with, cows grazing on the hills, no Dutch seascapes, no Dutch windmills anywhere in his works, no Dutch burgomasters. They really do not look Dutch. Hmm. And because of that, I think art historians have had a hard time coming to terms with who he really is and was as a painter.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's true, except, what you said about Not So Dutch is, I think, broadly true because of what he tries to be in other countries. Except for the late landscapes and portraits yeah. within drawings, and that's mm-hmm. when he sort of comes home. And there are some forest views which are close to Jacob van Rijsdael.
Those are really beautiful.
Some of
works.
The, you know, the portrait yeah. drawings are quite straightforward. Some of the portrait paintings. But the more he goes in for a kind of international style and turns to history subjects, whatever requires more, in a sense, imagination. Of course, realistic portraits do too, but it's not a matter of sheer invention to the degree mm. that it is when you are imagining a biblical story or a mythology. Mm-hmm. And that's when, in a sense, arbitrary and international style comes into the mix. And, you know, that can have somewhat schizophrenic results, or it can triumph when the flight of fancy is controlled by the bedrock of realism, in a sense, which goes back to his youth. That works out well. But sometimes you see the dichotomy a little painfully in the later work.
Well, was there an influence in terms of trying to sell his works? I guess part of the question, it seems to me from what I've read about him, that maybe he sold out in a way in order to make money. So instead of using the imagination and more creativity, he was doing portraits that were saleable.
That was true for...
He does have a mercenary aspect.
Yeah, but, you know, the very question is a kind of 19th century question, which presumes that artists... somewhat like a musician today, are utterly free to do what they want. And mm-hmm. we are rightly applying that in the sense that this is the first major open art market in Europe, because it's essentially a middle-class market for private homes, at least when he is at home in the northern Netherlands, and to some degree with middle-class patrons in London. But he was aiming at court patrons in London, and generally, like most Flemish painters, when he went to Antwerp, he's working for, to put it simply, the church and the state, the Catholic Church, or a network of nobility and court people. And so this idea that you're sort of, you know, being true to yourself or doing something which is unlike yourself is a luxury that artists like Bernini, Leonardo, you know, major figures could not afford.
Right.
So it's very much conditioned by that cultural context. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think I'd like to add one thing to that. I think you're absolutely right, and that's a wonderful description of how he's responding to the art world around him. But it's also sort of clear to me as you go through the exhibition that he's an artist who loves to experiment. Mm-hmm. And he's interested in everything he sees, and he tries to emulate everything he sees. His style, it's almost as if there's a kind of manifestation of these many styles of Jan Leven's. As you go through the exhibition, it seems to change every 5 years. And with Rembrandt, who's an amazing, wonderful painter, Rembrandt is so much more methodical, and there's a clear line of evolution in his work. And with Leven's, there are these moments where you just kind of look at the painting and say, you know, my goodness, what has he done here?
Where did that come from?
Where did it come from? Yeah. And it's clearly that he met another painter, he met another artist, or he saw something he was inspired by, and he just responded to it and really took it on. And so I've rarely seen another painter who is so willing to experiment.
In a word, it's eclectic. Yeah. He is sort of shopping for what he sees is the best in the international mm-hmm. community. And that's very different than the local tradition of Leiden that he grows up in. And I just wonder if he happened to be born and trained in Antwerp, he could have been one of the major figures there.
Really?
And instead, he moves to Antwerp, where there's already Rubens, Van Dyck, Jordaens, and 12 other highly competent people. And that was a pretty... tough gig to take on, I think.
He started painting when he was 8 years old. Is that right? Do we know much about those early years? This child prodigy has been attached to his name.
Well, there's a historian in Leiden named Jan Oehlers. And Oehlers is the first historian. He provides the first documentation of this young artist. He calls him a child prodigy. And he identifies a painting of an old woman reading as having been done by the artist when he was 14. You know, it's hard to say whether that's accurate or whether there's a little bit of art historical hyperbole in that. But clearly, he was recognized at a very young age as being a talented artist.
It's true that by the age of 10 or 12, I mean, these are not people who had to graduate high school before they started in a trade, and often it was their father's, uncle's, or someone else's trade. It was very much a middle-class profession. It cost money to train with another artist. And so given, say, 2 years of basic training and a minimum of 6 years of apprenticeship to an important master, it wasn't unusual to begin at 10 and be on your own as a beginning professional at 18.
Oh, my gosh.
Van Dyck was, for example.
It seems very young. Maybe I'm just thinking of, I know there are a lot of people who know a lot about the world when they're 18, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of people who don't have the breadth of experience to be able to paint the way this person did. Is there a marked difference between some of those early works? Do we have those early works and what he did later in his life?
A marked difference? You know, if that question were about Rembrandt, you would say no, that, that you know, essentially the things that Rembrandt did early on, which are based so much in observation of not just the way things look, but the way people behave, their expressions and so on, that as Rembrandt's style evolves, those basic interests in people, in psychology, and in visual appearances don't essentially change. Leavens had that himself in his early work, and it was very much encouraged by his close exposure to Rembrandt. And then he evolved away from that towards these various styles, which he sort of picked up and laid onto his early training. And I think what you said before, Laurie, about this symbiotic relationship between them is really very good, that in addition to Rembrandt being an important influence on Leavens in encouraging this discipline and interest in observation, character, etc., Leavens was the more eclectic and responsive to things in the art wind, in a sense, than Rembrandt was. And Rembrandt picked up, I think, quite a few compositional ideas from Leavens, who was always looking for something new.
And we have a clearer picture now of Leavens' early career. And there's a much stronger connection now with the Utrecht Caravaggisti.
Yeah.
And we'd always sort of thought that was there, but now through this exhibition, it really has become identified as a phase, and probably even likely that he may have gone to Utrecht, may have studied with the Utrecht painters. And the Utrecht Caravaggisti, I should explain just quickly what that is.
Sure.
It's a group of painters from Utrecht who traveled to Italy and were influenced by the work of the great Italian Baroque realist Caravaggio. They brought that drama and intensity and realism back to the north and transformed it into a particularly northern idiom. The concentration was of these painters was primarily in the city of Utrecht, fairly close to Leiden, and it seems pretty clear that he had a contact, Leavens now had a contact with those painters, like Han Thorst, Bob Buren, Terbruggen, and so forth. The connections in terms of the composition, the palette, the colors, the range, even the thickness and the vivacious sort of quality of the paint is really connected to those Utrecht artists.
Hmm. I'm sorry.
I could add, I don't know if you want a little art historical footnote to that.
Why not?
But I think, in fact, the town of Leiden, which is very much a university and mercantile town, it's comparatively small. It had the great cloth industry was centered there in the northern Netherlands, and to some extent the other major industry of the time, which was beer. Incidentally, very low alcoholic content, and because of the unsafe water, it was a staple of drinking. You know, this was an important middle class town. Because of the university, one of the oldest in Europe, it also was more sophisticated than most middle class mercantile places would be. And Honthorst, who you mentioned, who's the big shot in Utrecht, the more eastern city in the Netherlands, was the darling of the court in The Hague, which is just to the south. And Delft is only 3 miles from The Hague. And so we're talking about today's province of South Holland. And these centers, if we were talking about Italy, you know, Siena, Florence, Venice, etc., those are separate schools. But this is really all a region. And because of the court, these artists who worked in Caravaggio's manor originally from Rome were much better known. And there were even local representatives of this movement in Delft and what we call Gouda, which is pronounced Gouda. And so I think to some extent this was an expected source for Leavens, this Rome, Utrecht, and then Leiden connection.
Mm-hmm. So how many of the paintings in the exhibit right now and how many paintings generally have been mistakenly attributed to Rembrandt?
Nine paintings. In the exhibition were given to Rembrandt, once given to Rembrandt,
really?
Now reattributed to Leavens. And there are another five or six in the exhibition that were attributed variously to a Dutch painter named Jacob Bakker, the Flemish painter Van Dyck, and even, remarkably, the 16th century Italian painter Titian.
Huh.
So that gives you an idea of the range of styles. And works were also given to Honthorst. And it's interesting because, as I said earlier, the last exhibition was in 1979 on Jan Leavens. And the exhibition that we have today is remarkably different because so many works have now been reattributed to Leavens. There are works that have come out of private collections that we know about for the first time. Many of them have now come onto the market in just 2001 or 2004. The exhibition that we have today could not have happened even 5 years ago.
No.
Not even 10 years ago. So it's really is a kind of reassessment of this artist and who he is. Now, and there's a period where he spends 3 years in London. He's in Leiden. Then he goes to London to make his fame and fortune at court, to become a court painter, a court portraitist. And we don't have a single surviving painting from that period. We know that there are documents, commissions that he painted for. He painted the family of Charles I. We know documents for other portraits as well, and not a single one of those is known to us today.
Where did they go?
That's a question. We're hoping some of those come out of storage and are properly reattributed. But my guess is that some of those may have been lost. It's also likely, I think, that some of those are in private collections in English country homes, with the artist not being recognized. Or perhaps because he was at that point trying to really work in a kind of Flemish Van Dyckian style, perhaps they're attributed to Van Dyck or to the school of Van Dyck.
Yeah, that's the most likely thing, is that they're attributed to Van Dyck, but only attributed and considered rather minor works, maybe old copies, because they're of Charles I or whatever. We do have, of course, a few drawings and a few prints which make it clear that he is working in London, and the paper trail of paintings, but no certain English period.
It is a paper trail.
Yeah. Well, how do you discover then that it really isn't a Rembrandt? It's a Jan Leavens. How do you find it?
Well, I think maybe that
has
to be set in a broader context for a moment, which I'm very familiar with because of this Rembrandt, not Rembrandt show I did. Mm-hmm. And that was about 42 paintings in the Metropolitan Museum, part of the permanent collection, of which I would say 20 are actually Rembrandt. And two were from a later era, homages, copies, whatever. But 20 are by Rembrandt pupils, followers, associates, whatever they may be, during his lifetime. And if you look at Rembrandt catalogs that date from the really first generation of scholarship, around 1900 to 10 or 20, you have as many as 700 Rembrandt paintings thought to exist. The consensus today among specialists would be 300 Rembrandt paintings approximately. So that's 40% are actually by Rembrandt, and the others are from his lifetime for the great majority. And also, if you were talking to specialists around 1900, they could name maybe four or five alternatives. Bull, Flink, Leavens would be a suspect for early works, but really very few others. Now we know of about 40 Rembrandt pupils and followers, and we're really quite familiar with nearly half of them. And it's very much work on these other figures that have clarified what is Rembrandt and what is not Rembrandt. So the attributions that are now rightly made to Leavens and used to be to Rembrandt is a phenomenon we have for his followers throughout his career. And it's especially strong in the connection to Leavens because he's got so few associates early in his year. It's really his pupil Gerard Dow and a few minor figures, and Leavens, who was an equal in the early work, and an artist who's actually slightly older and equal in talent to Rembrandt, would be a figure who would paint pictures that you would think were by Rembrandt wrongly at a later date.
But this comes back to the question that you asked at the beginning of the hour, Kathleen, which is, you know, why this reassessment now? And how do we make this determination about attribution? And it seems to me that there are a lot of different ways it's done. And truthfully, this is the most commonly asked question that we have at the museum. It's how do you make the reattribution? In some cases, it's very clear. We clean the work, we remove the dirty varnish, and we discover the artist's monogram or the artist's signature. In some cases, it's purely connoisseurship, and that really is Walter's expertise is connoisseurship. So they look at very specific things. The type of brushwork, the color of the pigment, the way the paint is handled, the repetition of forms that might appear from one work to another. The way even an artist experiments and thinks about a subject is something that's brought into consideration.
And technical issues underpaintings, revisions, manners of drawing, but all of the technical means which reveal through X-rays or infrared light or whatever further information under or in the surface really give you a bigger bag of tricks that still must be judged against the package that you have from other people. And the essential question is not, is it good enough? Is it a matter of quality? But do the characteristics match the characteristics that you find in the other artists that you think it might be by? And those characteristics, the way a head is modeled, light is used, and so on, are linked to the person's psychology or, in a sense, personality. We all see the environment in different ways. And also, given that Leavens is so, as we said before, eclectic, he tends to respond to works of art. And Rembrandt, much more so, is making things up out of observations in the environment. And the difference between representing something on a flat surface when you're looking at the environment as opposed to looking at another flat surface where it's already transformed from the real world to the artistic world is a very great difference. And generally, Leavens is working more in that making art out of art area.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Or you could send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, John Goethe will be joining us. John is a historian and author. His books include The Making of Milwaukee and Cream City Chronicles, Stories of Milwaukee's Past. He's going to be giving the Zeidler Memorial Lecture coming up next week, and he's going to be looking at Milwaukee's socialist movement. Socialists ran Milwaukee for almost 50 years, so we'll be looking at that the second hour of our program today. 800-486-8655. We're particularly interested in hearing from many of you who have seen this exhibit. That would be nice. Or any questions you have, they're up for our consideration right now. Anne from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hello, Anne.
Hi. I saw the exhibit a few weeks ago. I really loved it. I have two comments. I wondered if your guests would like to comment on it. One was that one of my favorite paintings was the large still life. And the other comment is that I noticed some of the paintings came from Milwaukee, from a donor in Milwaukee, and I wondered if you'd like to talk about that a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Lori?
Hi. Well, we do have a private collector in Milwaukee who has lent four paintings to the exhibition. That would be Alfred and Isabel Bader. And they are wonderful works in the exhibition. They really are from different periods of quite an early work of St. Paul, a work that goes under the somewhat misleading title of Rembrandt's Mother, which is a portrait of an old woman, but we actually don't think it's more of a trony. It's not a specific portrait of a...
What's
of
a trony?
Trony is a kind of character study, different types of people. So quite often, Leavens in his old age painted... Leavens painted people in their older age. He was kind of fascinated by age and also did young children as well. So he was kind of looking at those two different poles of age.
Trony is an old-fashioned Dutch word, comes from the old French word trone, and it means face expression. It would be like mug, as in mugshot today.
Huh.
And it's become a category of painting, a character study.
Huh.
Yeah.
So we're very pleased, and I can just turn over the still life then to my colleague Walter. We're actually looking at an image of it right here in front of us.
Well, what page are we on?
I think
in the catalog, page 103.
Thank you.
All we can really say about it is that it is one of the closest, a work that was previously attributed to Rembrandt and represents one of their closest associations. I think it's, one of the most Rembrandtesque works in the exhibition. Also typical of Leiden in that we see a pile of old books in addition to drinking vessel. And in the background, another sign of knowledge or learning is... terrestrial globe and then a couple of musical instruments. So this is about the vanity of learning, which is something that was especially appropriate to this university town where many of the educated people in the Netherlands would have gone to learn. And the Dutch, they love these sort of disclaimers about their own achievements. They're wealthy, they're well-educated, they're sophisticated. At the same time, they want something in the picture, whether it's a portrait or a still life, that says, yes, but these are mere worldly achievements. And it's what matters is my soul in the end. I might say about the private collector also that he has been for decades concentrated in particular on the Rembrandt School. He has a few Rembrandts that he's also already given to institutions, but he has really specialized on the 40 or so people that we know that throughout Rembrandt's lifetime were either trained by him or closely influenced by him. So it's a remarkable reservoir for an exhibition like this.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that distinguishes, when you talked about the Dutch painting, what is it that distinguishes this particular era? Is it the richness? Is it the way the paint is applied? Is it because you know it when you see it? You obviously don't know Rembrandt when you see it because this guy is so close in many ways. But there's something that's just darn gorgeous about them. They're just beautiful. Yeah. What is it?
What is it about Dutch work?
Yeah.
Well, it's especially accessible to us in this modern era of private consumerism of art, et cetera, and also since the 19th century when there's been what you might describe as a realist aesthetic since, Courbet or actually much earlier, but this goes back to the Dutch, and the common denominator is private works of art for middle-class society. And our own country actively did not want other people's religions and mythologies when they were collecting in the 19th century. And an artist as great as Rubens, who Rembrandt admired enormously, Rubens was one generation earlier in the Spanish Netherlands, you could hardly get rid of one in America until about 1910 or so because it was a big public statement of, colorful work with a lot of energy and big scale, meant to be seen in a palace or a great Catholic church. So those are very public, you know, in a sense, advertising billboards for some national or religious credo. And the Dutch are much more intimate, more linked to nature and observation and the everyday values of people. And so no wonder it's accessible. It's basic human instincts and observations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if I can come back to the still life just for, for one moment. This gives me the opportunity just to talk about the market for Rembrandts in the 19th and 20th century. This particular work, The Still Life, with a musical instrument and other objects and books and other objects, was actually purchased by the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam as a Rembrandt. And there's no signature on it, and it looks sort of Rembrandt-esque. But it, this reflects, I think, the incredible optimism of the late 19th and 20th century to attribute works to Rembrandt, because he was, you know, everyone sort of bought into this myth of the romantic genius, the bohemian genius who refused to adapt and change his style. And as a consequence, you know, dealers wanted to sell Rembrandts, collectors and museums wanted to buy Rembrandts, and the optimism kicked in. People wanted to believe. And that's why a work like this, which is so beautiful, was once thought to be a Rembrandt. I mean, that's part of the reason. It's interesting because when this painting was done, Rembrandt wasn't even working on the scale. This is a very large painting, essentially 5 feet across. And at this point, Rembrandt would not have worked on the scale. He was doing works that were essentially 2 feet across, maybe 18 inches across. And so there was this just incredible desire to believe.
That's true. And also I think we inherit from the 19th century, in addition to a reverence for nature, there is this sort of mythology of genius. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that you're isolated in some Parisian garret or whatever. And, you know, it simply isn't true, especially in a 17th century culture. If you think of Leonardo, Michelangelo, whatever, coming from a Florence or another Italian city, we might know less about the Dutch cities, but the context is similar. A point I'll make in my lecture tonight at the museum is that during Rembrandt's lifetime, perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 pictures in his style were made, and he did 300 of those paintings, 10% of them. What does that say about the demand side of the equation, the people who wanted those works? And they were buying them directly from those other artists, 30 or 40 people, as what they were, what they really were. This is by Flink, Bol, Leavens, etc. So clearly there was this great social appreciation for the look of Rembrandt, which generally had to do with taking traditional stories and making them more vivid in visual and psychological terms. It could be an episode of the Bible, but it wasn't done like it was done in Italy. It was quite rethought, as if your neighbors were acting out the parts of the story. And that was accessible to a few million people in the Netherlands. So Rembrandt is really, I like to say, genius doesn't come out of nowhere, and he really came out of a major movement.
Mm-hmm. What time is the lecture? What's the title of the lecture? It's tonight, right? 6:15?
Tonight at 6:15,
and the title is What Have We Settled On?
Well, it's based partly on your own exhibition at the Met, so Rembrandt, not Rembrandt, Leavens.
That's what I thought, right, with a strong emphasis this time on Leavens.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Anne, for the call. We go next to John from Reidsville. Hi, John.
Hi. I'd like to know if the expert has any knowledge about the controversy of how the rise in optics affected the rise in realism in paintings. There are some that say that they use optical devices to help them draw. I'm going to hang up and take his comment off the air.
I think by the expert, he means me. And I have too much knowledge of this, more than I ever wanted, in a sense, or too much exposure to it, thanks to the British artist David Hockney, who's been a very keen enthusiast on this score. I'll try to make it short because this is not about leave-ins. But the idea is that lenses, camera obscuras, other automatic recording devices were used by Dutch artists or other realistic artists from anywhere from Jan van Eyck's era 200 years before onward. And I think that artists naturally took an interest in these visual devices. And we see Rembrandt mugging in front of a mirror in his early works. And some of the light effects he studies are very much about reflection, refraction, diffusion, all of these things. But the fact is they're making up works of art. And it's very naive to look at even a very realistic picture from the 15th or 17th century and to imagine it in photographic terms, as if, well, we see here Rembrandt's studio, and oh, isn't that interesting? He had this table off to the left. Mm-hmm. No, he didn't. He borrowed that from somewhere else or just worked for the composition. So I think they were interested and that they didn't need it. That would be the short answer. And basically, they didn't use it. It was another way of seeing, and whether they saw a visual phenomenon in a lens, in reality, or in another artist's work is nearly irrelevant. It's the way they use it in their picture, which is the achievement.
I would imagine that it must be a wonderful feeling to present an exhibit like this from an artist who wasn't given his due, who's done beautiful paintings, and you can attribute works to him that you thought were done by Rembrandt, to bring to the public for the first time for a major exhibition. That must be just a really good feeling. Here's somebody new, and by golly, he's fabulous.
It is great. But let me just comment quickly on the significance of the exhibition.
Sure.
It opened at the National Gallery in Washington, which has this phenomenal collection of Dutch and Flemish painting. It's now here in Milwaukee, and obviously we are thrilled to be part of this exhibition experience. But significantly, after it leaves here, it will go to the Rembrandt House in Amsterdam.
Oh.
They are taking down Rembrandt's to put up Leavens. So Rembrandt has, you know, 350 years later, 400 years later, finally has his due. and in the Rembrandt House of all places.
That's a great story. Thanks for the call, John. Our number is 800-486-8655. Phil from Madison is next. Hello, Phil.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm curious. Something was referred to as, I believe, Van Eyckian earlier, but then a gentleman named Van Dyck was referenced. So I'm curious if we know these people as late persons, if we know these artists that were making these supposedly Rembrandts, either his pupils or whoever they were, and if these works have kind of permeated the general consciousness, do we know these Rembrandts or these things that were supposedly Rembrandts, or are they just sort of minor works? And I guess I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Walter.
Thank you.
Well, I mentioned Van Eyck briefly in connection with optics, and of course he works in the 1430s and 40s and is part of the dawn of the Netherlandish tradition. Rembrandt's looking back 200 years to him. Van Dyck with a D, who in the 19th century in this country was occasionally described as British because he did so many great English portraits, is from the Spanish Netherlands, and like Rubens, he began his work in the great Antwerp port of the great Flemish port of Antwerp, which was like the New York City of the Spanish Netherlands at the time. We're talking about today's Belgium. And he was the international superstar of portraiture and to some extent religious painting during the 1630s and 40s, and a great influence on Leavens once he left the Northern Netherlands, the Dutch Republic, and went to firstly London, where Van Dyck had already worked and was about to show up again, and then went on to Antwerp. The broader question about works, do we know these works, etc., we know them more now than ever, and many of, well, I would say especially in the case of Leavens, there are, I think in particular, early works by Leavens which are every bit as fine or in some cases more successful as works by Rembrandt. And you find you know, isolated cases, certainly not the entire oeuvre of a later artist who followed Rembrandt, Flink, Bol, Nicholas Maas, whoever, but there are cases that I would describe where their version of a given biblical subject or whatever is actually more successful than Rembrandt's and in some cases better painted. He is a far greater artist most of the time, but this is, you know, very much not a matter of absolute quality, but of different approaches and their individual characteristics. Because of the sheer volume of publishing in our time, I mean, I never imagined when I went to, you know, the beginning of graduate work around 1970, that I could open a volume of, well, six volumes of 3,000 photos of paintings of the Rembrandt School, you know, which is this right. visual index of 40 people and now individual monographs on all of them. I go to Europe maybe 4 or 5 times a year on short trips. If there's a museum show somewhere, I'm there, you know, usually at multiple stops. And these advantages simply didn't exist 40, 50 years ago, let alone at the dawn of Dutch studies 100 years ago. So it's a very different game now, this business of attribution. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have museums with laboratories. Pictures get cleaned, photographed, examined with all kinds of technical means today. Mm-hmm. So we can be very satisfied with our knowledge today, but we have to realize we have tremendous advantages that earlier generations didn't have in studying this material.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing how old it is, isn't it? You must think about that every time you look at them or when you handle these. These are old.
Yeah, 400 years in
right.
many cases.
400 years old. Laurie's saying this. No, you must think of them as being a part of now, too,
well,
which they are in your world, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did this guy, I'm always interested in the stories behind the artist, how did this guy with all this enormous talent, starting so young, friend of Rembrandt's, friend of the courts, die with no money?
Well, so did Rembrandt, actually.
Yeah,
did he?
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, that's a sad story.
I mean, one of the short and more global answer is that when the economy dips, luxury goods are the first thing to go. And if you think of Vermeer, who was cranking out's exactly the wrong term for this, because he worked very slowly and produced works for 500-600 guilders a pop in the case of Vermeer, doing maybe 2, at the most 3 paintings a year, and 600 guilders would be a middle-class annual income. He does that for 20 years, and then the French invade the country, the economy dips, and he's penniless and can't support his 11 surviving children, and dies at the age of 43 going mad. And, you know, so in the 1670s, and even Rembrandt goes, in the case of Rembrandt, he was also a bad money manager and overspent on houses and collections. But and Leavens is running around to different cities competing with great big shots. It's actually a story which you hear about Domenichino, one of the great international geniuses of Italian painting, who had this gift for showing up in certain cities at precisely the wrong time, because there was Rubens or some other person who just overwhelmed him. But he had a much more successful career. So this is the real world with, you know, competition from patrons and taste and fashion, and a person like Rembrandt could suddenly be a loser in terms, in economic terms.
Well, and we can bring this into our own time. It's not unlike the financial crisis we're having today.
Yeah.
Rembrandt died a pauper in 1669. Leavens had the misfortune of living 5 years beyond that because he witnessed the great financial collapse in Holland in 1672, which was also the year the French invaded. And as a consequence, his clients were not able to take delivery on the paintings. They couldn't pay for them. And suffered exactly the same fate, as you said, that Vermeer did. So the last we hear of Leavens, he's lost his home. He has all of his goods in a little push cart, and he's been able to, he thinks, rent an apartment. He shows up and he meets the landlord, and he doesn't have enough money for the first month's deposit on the apartment, and he's turned away. And so there he is with all of his goods in a little push cart in Amsterdam in the street. And here's this great artist who was, you know, the painter of royalty, and he comes to this fate.
More phone calls we welcome in a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. And this hour, we talk about Jan Leavens out of Rembrandt Shadow on display now through February. When is it going?
The exhibition lasts through April 26th.
April 26th at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And our two guests, Laurie Winters, Director of Exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum, curator of this particular show and many other very successful shows, and also joining us is Walter Lidka. He is curator of European paintings at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Did I give you the number? Again, it's 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's go to Gary from Wauwatosa. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I was just wondering, with the reattribution of these paintings, these Rembrandt paintings to Leavens, what does that do to the monetary value of the paintings? Does it go down, or does it stay the same, or go up?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it is.
Walter, would you take that?
I think it's very much the individual case, and it depends on a lot of other factors like condition, quality, what the subject is. It has, you know, the essence of the question is it's gone from an uncertain Rembrandt to a certain Leavens, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that could very well be a gain. It could be a draw. But generally speaking, a picture convincingly attributed to a known artist who is recognized in the world of collecting as an important figure is more valuable than a slightly, even slightly doubted attribution to another figure, even if he were a greater name.
Hmm. And because he's becoming quite recognized now with this exhibition and the one that will take place in Holland, in the Netherlands, I would imagine his stock has gone up significantly in the past year, hasn't it?
I think that definitely more and more people are paying attention to him. The National Gallery hosted a symposium in January on Jan Leavens. So it was an opportunity to bring together scholars from around the world who study Dutch art and to really just have an ongoing conversation, to start an ongoing conversation about this painter. And I know that's how my colleague Arthur Wheelock views this exhibition. It's a beginning, and it's a first conversation, and I expect we will see some more remarkable paintings by this artist emerging from the shadows.
Yes, yes, which is pretty exciting for you, people in your business, isn't it?
It's very exciting.
I know the museum does these wonderful series of lectures surrounding the exhibition. You want to go to all of them, and you can't, but you brought Walter in to speak tonight. Can you give us a little more information about what else is coming up? Are you having more people talk about Leavens or related subjects?
We are. We do like to do educational programming around every exhibition, and I think it's been particularly outstanding with this exhibition. And to have Walter here is, you know, it's just great. So thank you for coming, Walter.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, in a more general way, on Sunday, April 5th, we will have a speaker. His name is Mike Dash, who has written a best-selling book called The Tulip Mania, the story of the world's most coveted flower and the extraordinary passions it aroused. And the tulip
Great.
Mania, was it the fascination with the tulip, was in many ways responsible for the financial crisis that occurred in the 1670s. We'll hear about that. And in connection with this exhibition, we'll be hosting in early April Art in Bloom. So it's an annual event for us, and this year there is a tulip theme. So when you come, you will certainly see quite a few tulips in the museum, and it's an occasion when we have almost 50 garden clubs and florist from the Wisconsin area who produce beautiful bouquets in conjunction with works of art. So that'll be a nice time to feel a little Dutch.
Yes, that's wonderful. Don't you love the museum, Walter? I don't even have to see art. All I have to do is go and stand in the museum, and it's made my day.
Well, in addition to wanting to see Leavens again, and it's always a revelation to see it in different locations, Washington, and maybe I'll even see it in Amsterdam, but you've got this extraordinary building by Calatrava, mm-hmm. which we're kind of envious of in New York. We have our own Calatrava project, which apparently isn't coming off like it was supposed to. And you did it here. That's an amazing thing.
We don't mind hearing that you from New York might be envious of those of us who are in Milwaukee. That's good to hear. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was just a wonderful hour.
Great
love
pleasure.
Doing
Thanks.
These shows. Thank you. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much. And remember that the exhibit, give me the dates again, is running through April.
Runs through April 26th.
April 26th. So be sure and go to the Milwaukee Art Museum sometime before April 26th and see this exhibit. We thank Lori Winters, Director of Exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and she has brought us some marvelous exhibitions in her time at the museum. Walter Lidka is the curator of the European Paintings Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Again, he is speaking tonight at 6:15. And it's open to the public. He has lectured and published very widely on Dutch artists, and we thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Stay with us. We have an interesting hour ahead talking about socialism in Milwaukee, and it made a huge imprint the early part of the 20th century. So we'll talk about socialism and particularly about Frank Zeidler with John Gerda, who is giving the memorial lecture at our library on Frank Zeidler and socialism in Milwaukee next week. This is the Ideas Network.